Rav Silberman is one of the go-to people in the country for Geirus issues, as well as for Gittin issues, but we're not learning Gittin this summer, we're learning Geirus this summer. My relationship with him goes back to Karen Biavna, where at some point at the end of my Shana Aleph, word started spreading around the Beis Medrash that there's going to be someone coming next year who's going to put all the Shana Bet guys to shame, Kachava, and he's a wonderful Rebbe in our Smicha program at Yeshiva University, helps run the Basin of America. It's a very, very great opportunity, especially in light of the fact that we've been learning Geirus the whole summer.
Thank you, Rabbi Leibowitz. It's an honor to be here, a pleasure to be here. My recollection of Rabbi Leibowitz goes back to the same Karmi Adam of Kufa, even though we weren't NTA together, but a year apart. My recollection is that when I was Shana Aleph from Rabbi Leibowitz and Shana Bet, he was my go-to person for asking every question I had, especially during night seder when he was found in the Beis Medrash very late at night and always accessible and always willing to help out people a little bit less advanced. And my admiration for him has only grown in the many years since then. So you're honored to have opportunity to learn from him over the summer, and I'm honored to spend a little bit of time with you this morning. I understand that you're talking about or learning about Hilchos Geirus this year. I thought that we talk about some kind of more cheerful. Hello, David. How are you?
Can hear us here.
I thought we'd talk about some more cheerful Geirus topics, and the title I thought we kind of subsume it under is historical Geirus controversies, but I'd be very happy to leave things open for any other broad questions at the end, or if you want to stop me short or stop in the middle to ask any questions, please feel free to do so. Just a couple words of Hakdama as far as my involvement in Geirus professionally. In the year 2007, there were major politics, there were always major politics about Geirus every year, but in 2007, as I was finishing the Kol Elyon, there were major Geirus politics, and the Rabbanut HaRashit, under the leadership of Rav Shlomo Amar Shlita, who was then the Rav Rashi, now the Rav, still the Rishon LeZion, and the Rav Rashi Yerushalayim, he had indicated that there was a lot of uneven standards in American Geirus, and he wasn't going to just automatically accept every Geirus done by every ad hoc bez in the U.S. So that kind of led to a self-reflection on the part of the American Rabbinate, particularly under the leadership of the RCA, and the Bezin of America, how are we doing Geirus? Maybe we could be doing Geirus better. And the RCA, together with the Bezin of America, came up with a new system called the GPS, Geirus Policies and Standards System. That was before people had these navigational devices, so I probably wouldn't have called it that otherwise had we known. But so they turned it the GPS system of Geirus, and what happened was, instead of every rabbi doing Geirus in his own backyard, putting together two chaverim on an ad hoc basis, with uneven, unpredictable standards, and no one could guarantee whether or where it would be accepted. So we decided to centralize Geirus, as is done in many other parts of the world, that our recommendation would be that there should be regional Batei Din around the country, and those regional Batei Din would service their region, their geographic region. There would be uniform standards and uniform understandings as to what is required for Geirus to be done al pi halacha, and then someone would know what they're getting. If you get a Geirus under the RCA and Bezin of America auspices, that should be accepted anywhere in the world, and you shouldn't have to worry about your status going forward. So I was brought in to kind of run that system. There were many skeptics at the time, including many chashuva rabbanim that whose names we will mention, who advised that this is going to collapse in a few months. Don't even bother getting into it. But Baruch Hashem, it seems to have continued, and we've relatively successfully changed a lot of how Geirus is done in America, and Achshur Dora, we're much better off for it. Rabbi Leibowitz serves as one of the Dayanim of the Manhattan Basin for Geirus, which does Geirus in the New York area. Baruch Hashem, we think it seems to be doing well. Throughout history, for many parts of history, Geirus wasn't a very practical topic for the simple reason that throughout most of medieval Europe, early modern Europe, well into the 20th century, it was illegal to be Megayer just about anywhere. Now, we know that in the times of David Shlomo, the Gemara in Yavamas and a couple places called Dalai in Zion, that there were 250,000 Geirim. We know that in the time of Mordechai Ve'ester, Rabim Me'aris Misyahadim, Pashup Shah Misyadim means they're Megayer. The Gaon has a pshat that it means they pretended to be Jewish, that they acted Jewish, but they weren't really Jewish. They weren't Megayer. Some say that's why we dress up in Purim. But aside from that, and maybe certain periods during the Roman time where there might have been geiris done, but aside from that, for much of medieval and early modern history, well into the modern era, there's almost no geiris going on. There were the celebrated cases, the geiris tzedek of Vilna, etc. But that's why if you look at the tshuva literature in the early achronim, kimat, you don't have much discussion about geiris because it wasn't really practical. Only in the mid-1900s, with the state of Jewry, what it was then, and the post-Enlightenment, and the ghetto walls breaking down, was it possible and then practical in certain places for geiris to take place? Sometimes for sincere motivation, sometimes for ulterior motivations, the Shemishas, the Gemara and Kaf Dalet that you probably discussed. There's a Tshuva Rebbe Kiveger, for example, Chelek Aleph, Siman Mem Aleph. Rebbe Kiveger is asked about the propriety of teaching Torah to a Nochri for the purposes of being Megayer. There's an Isser, as you know, Nochri is not allowed to learn Torah, not Gaisha Shabbat Chayim Misa, Gaisha, if a Nochri learns Torah, there's Chayim Misa. So Rebbe Kiveger is asked, are you allowed to teach Torah to Ger in preparation for Ger? So we'll assume, obviously, yes, because if you're going to Megayer someone and he's not going to know anything, it'll be Mechal Shabbos for Shabbos. There's a Chuvas Minchas Lazar, the Munkashri Torah, right, like that. And that's the practice of all Bati Din. We don't, even though the Gemara says that the civil reading of the Gemara and Daf Mem Zayin is that once he decides that he's sincere and he's willing to get into, wants to be Jewish. So then Mabil and Samiyat doesn't mean that he has to know what he's doing, so he's not going to be Mechal Shabbos for Shabbos. So presumably you have to teach him at least halachos that he needs to know in order to be Megayer. But Rebbe Kiveger is a little skeptical about that. He's not so sure. The Marsha Chan the Gemara in Shabbos Amud Aleph by Hillel and Gairani Amanas Shia Kohen Gadol. So the Marsha understood it doesn't mean that he's Megayim right away. It means that he told him go learn the halachos and then he'll be Megayim you. So you see from there apparently that you're allowed to teach Torah to an Nochri in preparation for Geiris. So Rabbi Kiveger is skeptical about that. Moshe writes against that. We don't assume later Kiveger. But the Shiloh, the way it's supposed to be Rabbi Kiveger, is that a person is living in a country where you can't be Megayer, and then he thinks that he's going to go somewhere and be Megayer in some other country. So Rabbi Kiveger says, in that case, it's not even Shayach. That's how Moshe understands Rabbi Kiveger. That maybe Rabbi Kiveger would agree that if it's Shayach to be Megayer now, then he can learn the relevant halachas. He's talking about a case where it's not Shayach to be Megayer at all because you live in a country where it's not possible. There was someone wrote a study about the Pinchas of the London Besdin in the beginning of the 1800s. The book, I forget the name of the author, it was a book about Australian Jewry. The Jews in Australia, Jews started moving to Australia. Originally it was a penal colony. They sent all the criminals from England. And, sorry, I forgot to acknowledge Rabbi Rassner's presence. Covet to have you here. Originally they sent all the rejects to Australia. And then apparently the first time they had to do a ghetto in Australia in the mid-1800s, they sent someone from the London Bez, and he ended up spending 2 or 3 years there. So this guy made an analysis of the Pinchas, the ledger of the London Bez. And so in London, well into the 19th century, geiris was illegal. And apparently there were two situations in which they did geiris in London. One of them was if the father was Jewish and the mother wasn't Jewish, so logically speaking, the person's not Jewish, so they need a geiris. But as far as Dina de Malchusa, it wasn't illegal to convert someone whose father was Jewish because based on Dina de Malchusa, that person was considered Jewish. So they do a geiris in that kind of situation. And then they do a geiris in a situation where, let's say they thought the person was sincere, it's appropriate to do a geiris, but they can't do it legally. So they send them to Amsterdam, which is one of the few places in Europe where it was legal. And then they go back to England, but the London Besdin wouldn't accept the geiris of the Besdin in Amsterdam, so they did another geiris of Chumrah. So as far as Dina de Malchusa, they held that the original geiris in Amsterdam was a good geiris, but they didn't accept the geiris in Amsterdam, so they, al pi halacha, did another geiris of Chumrah. But that just speaks to the rarity of geiris well into the 19th century. So one of the halacha controversies, if you will, that came up in the middle of the 19th century is something that was brought to the attention of the rabbinic establishment by Rabbi Bernardi Lowy. Rabbi Bernardi Lowy is one of the heroes of early American Jewish history. Anyone ever hear of him? Okay, great. So Rabbi Lowy was a Talmud of the Chassid Sofer. He had a doctorate from the University of Budapest in philosophy. And apparently he was on the wrong side of the revolutions of 1848. He was found with some revolutionary currency. He had to leave the country. and he came to the U.S. He was a Rav in many cities. He was a Rav in Baltimore. He was a Rav in New Orleans. He was in Baltimore at the beginning of the Civil War, and he was such a stark secessionist that they hired him to be the Rav in New Orleans because he gave a very strong secessionist drashos. And then when he was in New Orleans was the first town to one of the first towns to fall to the north in the south. So then he did tshuva, and by the time Lincoln was assassinated, he gave a big hesped for Lincoln. But anyway, so he was in New Orleans. He died in Cincinnati. He's buried in Cincinnati. So he was in New Orleans during the Civil War. So he was a fascinating person. His son put together tshuvas that his father wrote. It was called Sefer Melchamos Elokim, the controversial letters and the casuistic decisions of the late Rabbi Bernard Eloi, Ph.D., by his son Henry Eloi, M.D., professor of diseases of the children in the Cincinnati College of Medicine and Surgery. Okay, so he has fascinating tshuvas there, but he corresponded with a lot of the development of Europe. He was the one who was responsible for introducing into the halachic discussion the kashas of the Muscovy duck, Rabbi Leibowitz's former classmate, Rabbi Loki's area of expertise. So there was this duck waddling around in New Orleans, and so we assume that you have to have a Mesorah for what's considered a kosher bird. So he asked around, where's the Mesorah? He said, the Baal Batim said, we always ate this. So he wasn't sure about that, so he sent the Shiloh to the Gedolim in Europe, and that was the beginning of the literature that most posts can assume that we don't eat the Muscovy duck because you don't have a Mesorah. So he writes that he was in New Orleans in the early 1860s. When he got to town, no one had a sukkah. They didn't know what sukkah was. Two people in the whole town had a sukkah, and he convince them to become more religious. By the time he left, there were dozens and dozens of sukkahs in New Orleans in the 1860s. So he dealt with the following question. There was a lot of intermarriage in New Orleans, and there were a lot of situations where you'd have a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother, and the Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother, and they wanted to do a milah on the kids. So we don't usually do milah on non-Jews. And there wasn't any geiris in the works over here. If someone is part of a geiris process, then you'll do milah because that's the first stage of geiris. But there was no havmin of geiris here. These people were happily intermarried, and the local mo'olim were doing milahs on these kids. So number one, we don't do milahs on nachrin. Number two, it would give people the impression that these kids are Jewish when in fact they're not halachically Jewish. So he issued a ban that none of the mo'olim in New Orleans should do milahs for these types of children. Two of them all listened to him, one of them didn't, and this is a whole taram, the American newspapers at the time, the Jewish newspapers, the Messenger, and the Accident out of Philadelphia, Leiser. So he corresponded with the Gedolim of Europe about this. He corresponded with Rabbi Yosef Kalischer and with Rabbi Israel Hildesheim. Rabbi Yosef Kalischer was most famous for his Drisha Sion and his advocacy for being Mechadesh Karbanus Bizman Ezel Makam Mikdash. And Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer was one of the Gedolim in Germany at the time. So this is a discussion that is printed in the Tshuvas of Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, Tshuvas Rabbi Israel beginning in Simen Reish Kaftes, and then the few Tshuvas afterwards. It's a back and forth between Rabbi Yosef Kalischer and Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. So one of the things they discuss is it the case that the child of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother has some status, has some halachic status. So they point to a pasuk in Ezra, in Perek Tes. In the time of Ezra, there was rampant intermarriage also. And the pasuk there has the expression, Zera Kodesh, holy seed. So according to Rabbi Zeal Hildesheimer, he suggests that maybe, even though we paskin matrilineal descent, but Yosef Kalischer thought that maybe Zera Yisrael means that there's some shemetz of Jewishness for the child of a Jewish father and non-Jewish mother, and Hildesheimer rejected that out of hand. No, Zera Kodesh means that the children had a Jewish father. They come from some Kedusha, but the children have no halachic status of Jewish whatsoever. So we assume generally on this specific Nakuda, like Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer against the Sfirish Kalischer, that there's no status of Zera Yisrael per se. However, it is relevant in the following context, and this does come up quite often. When you crunch the numbers, as we've crunched the numbers as far as Geir is done over the years, the last 15 years that we've had the system, so in terms of general motivations, why people come to Megayir, it kind of breaks down into thirds. About a third of the people are Megayir for what we'll call ulterior motivation, most typically L'shem Ishus, there's a Jewish significant other in the picture, And that's what spurs them to do geira. So our practice is along the lines of Chai Moses Shuvas and Achiezer, Chela Gimel Kavzayin Kavches, that even though, strictly speaking, L'chachili not supposed to be geira some L'shem Ishos, but we paskin anyway, as we know, Kavdalid Kulam Geirim Heim, that the evidence of good geiras. But if someone comes for initially ulterior motivations, but a Bezin is able to discern that at the end of the day, there are certain elements of sincerity there that would transcend the relationship, and the Bezin can make an assessment that even if the relationship were to go sour and the significant other would fall out of the picture, the person would remain observant. So we say that's not really called the L'shem Ishus. At the end of the day, the person has some sincere motivation as well. So most Batei Din will be Megayer, people under the circumstances, some won't. Rav Nata Greenblatt, the Chronicle of Rav, who just passed away a few months ago, was a phenomenal gadol that had influence in so many areas of halachic observance and practice in America. So his personal anhaga was never to be megayer anyone that was megayer l'shem ishus under any circumstances. But most Batei Din will be megayer even if there's an ulterior motivation, if we could discern independent sincerity. So about one third of people that are megayer are what we'll call for ulterior motivation. One third of people that are megayer because they believe that this is the truth and they sincerely see the light. And the final third are megayer because they have some kind of Jewish identity. Jewish identity could be a Jewish father, not a Jewish mother. Jewish identity could be that there's a non-halachic conversion on the maternal line. The mother might have had a non-halachic conversion, the grandmother might have had a non-halachic conversion. So people who identify as Jewish but are not halachically Jewish. So this question, the machlokas of Brazil Hildesheimer Swedish College, is relevant to the following. So you probably discussed that there's a certain tension that exists in terms of our approach to geiros candidates, a tension between dechia, between pushing them away, and between kiruv. As on the one hand, the most famous Maharal Makom in Hilchos Geiros, you ask anyone on the street, what do they know about geiros, so what will they tell you? Sorry? Good, so that's what the Gemara says about, in terms of skepticism, but most people on the street may not know that Gemara. But if you ask any less learned person on the street, what do you know about geiros? So the learned person would say that. Good. And what would an unlearned person say? Exactly, right. So the unlearned person would say, you have to push them away how many times? Three times. Where does it say that? With Rabbah. Where is the quote of Lalacha? Rokeach. But not in Shulchan Aruch, not in Rambam, not in Standard Nosekel and Reposkin. So at least before I was involved in this professionally, I think it's probably still true. If you have someone in the street who knows nothing about geiros, I'll probably quote you that Mar Malkum, which is not quoted in normative halachic sources. What we do have is a Gemara that you probably learned on Mem Zayin, that you have to discourage someone in the sense that you have to tell them that it's hard to be a Jew, or the Hufim, etc. And it sounds like the motivation for that is to discourage that people should be aware what they're getting into. The Smag, basically, quote, sounds like it's a matter of buyer's remorse, that they shouldn't come to you after the fact and say, had I known how difficult being a Jewish, then I wouldn't have done it. Had you not told me about the mitzvahs kalos v'chamuros, I wouldn't have done it. Right, Pashup Shad, the mitzvahs chamuros, where the Bach says, is that why do we tell, so we tell the mitzvahs mitzvahs chamuros and mitzvahs mitzvahs kalos. So why do we tell them both the chamuros and the kalos? Because chamuros, you have to discourage them. The kalos is to tell them, it's not so bad, there are some easy mitzvahs too, we'll give you a break. The Meiri writes over there that Mrs. Kalos also is to discourage them, because if you explain to them that halacha governs every minutia of our life, even how you tie your shoelaces, so then that also discourages them. If people think you're converting, so okay, you have to do Shabbos, Kashrus, Haras, and Mishracha, and then the rest of the day you have a pass. So no, that halacha governs every aspect of our life, so you have to be aware of that. Okay. But anyway, so on the one hand, you have this notion of dechia, and as you said, probably the reason we're dochah is, number one, to avoid buyer's remorse, number two is because of sapachas, whatever sapachas means, major method for shonim, I'm sure you discussed. So that's one reason why we're dochah, so those are the reasons why we're dochah. But on the other hand, the Gemara seems to indicate that once they decide that they really want to convert anyway, so then mabilin oso miyat, and then the hemshech of that the Amshe of that Medrash Rabbah, after it says that Shovna, 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 you have to be Dafka three times, then it says, Amra Yitzchak Bachutz Lo Yelenger, Lo'olam Yehei Adam Docha B'Smolu Mekablu B'Yamin, that you have to have a balance. You have to be Docha, but you also have to be Mekarev. And that's the Gemara in Sanhedrin about Timna, that the Avos were criticized, the Avos were punished, because Timna wanted to become part of the fold of B'nai Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and she was rejected, so she ended up becoming Pilegers to Eliphaz. And that was a punishment to the Avos. Amalek emerged because the Avos were not properly Mekarev Timna. So there's a balance between Kiruv and Duchiyah. So where this Rizul and Holy Time is relevant is sometimes that balance may shift. If someone comes in off the street and says, I would be Megayer, so we have to be Docha them. Again, Docha doesn't mean you have to be rude. It should be nice, but you have to make sure they know what they're getting into and are fully sincere and committed. If someone is coming in because they have a Jewish identity, so the standards at the end of the day are going to be the same. They still require a full Kabbalah and Mitzvahs, but we're not going to have the same orientation of Dechiyah per se. We may be more inclined to work with them, especially if they have a non-halachic conversion and maybe they're Suffolk Jewish on some level, so then we definitely want to work with them. Maybe then there's even a cure of impediment. Someone's Tam is halachically not Jewish without question. The mother's definitely not Jewish, but they're interested in being Megayer, so we're not going to do Kirov, but if they come on their own, we're not going to be Docha in the same way. So this Zer Yisrael has some resonance, even if it's not accepted fully l'alacha. You know, some people go with the Zer Yisrael and run with it. A former Chaver Knesset, Chaim Amsalem, who used to be a Chaver Knesset in Shas, wrote this whole book entitled Zer Yisrael, trying to argue for a watered-down definition of Kabbalah Samitzvos. And when it came out, I asked my sister to buy for me an Eretz Yisrael, 160, 180 shekels, very expensive. It wasn't worth it. But but he has this whole book that he argues along the lines of Zer Yisrael that we have to try to be Megayer more actively people with any Jewish identity, even without a proper Kabbalah Samitzvos. So that far we don't go. But if the person is sincere and wants to convert, we're not going to be docha them the same way that you would try to be docha someone coming off the street. Okay. Some may have the orientation that we don't have, that if you have an intermarried couple, maybe the percentages shift a little bit also. Maybe it should be Mekarev. We're not of that orientation. Rav Asher Weiss has a tshuva in which he indicates that maybe Kiruv would be in order in that kind of a situation as well. Okay, so that's halachic controversy number one. The Machlokas of Tzvi Yosh Hildesheimer and Rav Zil Hildesheimer, Tzvi Yosh Kalischer, about Zer Yisrael. Just as another historical footnote, another fascinating tshuva that Rabbi Lowy has in his collection was a woman in Nashville who also speaks to the rarity of Geiris in those times outside of America. In America, it was already very prevalent because of intermarriage, not so yet in Europe. So he writes that there is a frum woman in Nashville who passed away and wanted to be buried in Kibbutz Yisrael, wanted to have a proper halachic burial. She had been born non-Jewish, was married to a Jewish guy, and she converted somewhere in Europe, and they were ostensibly Shomrei Torah Mitzvah. The problem was she had no proof, no documentation of her Geirus, because she was Megayer somewhere in Europe where Geirus was illegal, so the Bezin wouldn't give her any Ksav because they didn't want to be held liable for doing something illegal. So she had no evidence of the fact that she was Jewish. So he discusses, not really our topic for now, but he discusses on what basis could we prove someone in that situation as being Jewish. Okay. So also in the mid 1800s, you discussed the Malvolo Tavol controversy of 1848. Not yet. Yeah, you did.
No.
Oh, okay. So you discussed Mila Tvila yet? Okay, so as you know, the basic requirements of Geirus include Mila for male and Tvila, Korban, when you can bring a Korban, Kabbalah Samitzvos. There was a case in 1848 in Yerushalayim, celebrated a case of the Mal V'lo Tavol. There was a non-Jew who was being Megayer with the Bezdin of Shmuel Salant. Again, a rarity in those years, even in Eretz Yisrael. And the situation was that he had undergone a mila. There were complications for the mila. And it took some time for the mila to heal before they could do the tefillah. So the mila was in the middle of the week. Came Shabbos. He had done a mila yet, but not yet a tefillah. So Shmuel Salant was out of town. The big shilas always happen when the rabbi's out of town. And his deputy, the Abezdin, was Rabbi Asher Lemel. So Rabbi Asher Lemel sent a message to this Malvolo Taval that you should be Michal Shabbos because you're not fully halachically Jewish. And Goy Shabbos Chayim Misa. So the message was you have to be Michal Shabbos. So apparently this ger was very upset about it, making him Michal Shabbos. He did it. And then that created a whole taram in the halachic literature, was Rabbi Asher Lemel right? So the Aruch Laner, the Binyan Tzion, had a Torah journal, Shamir Tzion and Emana. So he printed in that Torah journal many of the back and forth on this topic, and most of the poskim, for different reasons, thought that Rabbi Asher Lemel was wrong. Now, before getting to the substance of that, a historical footnote, in the Binyan Tzion's tshuva, so the Binyan Tzion writes that the ger in question was a ger Morokai, a Moroccan ger. So it had always bothered me that apparently there were two celebrated cases of geiris in 1848 in Yerushalayim. One was this Moroccan geir, and the other one was a fellow by the name of Warder Cresson. Warder Cresson was a Quaker who wanted to go to Eretz Yisrael, and he was able to secure an appointment as the first American consul general in Palestine under Secretary of State John Calhoun. He went to Eretz Yisrael, and they had revoked his minoy as the consul general, so he just stayed there. And then, over time, he decided that the truth was in Yadus, and he was Megayer. The footnote to that is that he came back to America, to Pennsylvania, to close up his affairs. He was sued in court for lunacy, because he'd have to be crazy to be Jewish. His wife wanted to, his wife, who he wanted to divorce, wanted all of his assets. So he lost the first round and then won on appeal, and then went back to Eretz Yisrael and lived out the rest of his life there. So it struck me as odd that there are two celebrated cases of geiris in Yerushalayim in 1848. Then I saw a number of years ago that the Baal HaSfarim blog, Rabbi Rabinowitz, wrote a piece, and he proved very convincingly, based on dates, that these people were one and the same. That the famous Malvolo Taval was none other than the famous Warder Cresson. And when the Binyan Tzion writes Ger Morokai, he meant to write Ger Amerikai, an American Ger. So that solves that historical dilemma. It was all the same person. But anyway, in the literature, so most of the poskim wrote against Rabbi Asher Lemel that a Malvolo Taval should keep Shabbos. Why? So the Binyan Tzion thinks that maybe the model is Mara. Klal Yisrael, we learn out the luck of the Geirus from Mamon Har Sinai. Mamon Har Sinai was the final act of Geirus, but Klal Yisrael, the Nesel, had Mila and Mizrayim. So they already were Nimolim in Mizrayim. They kept Shabbos in Mara. And then the Tefillah was at Har Sinai. So no one less than the Nesel themselves were Malvolo Tavals when they kept Shabbos. So he thought that's the model for keeping Shabbos. Anyway, in a situation of Suffolk, so most poskim assume that the Malvolo Taval would keep Shabbos. If you have a clash between a Yisrael Shechil Shabbos and a Goy Shabbos, usually we're machmer on the side of avoiding Chil Shabbos for Yisrael. Let's say you have a Suffolk Jew. So what do you tell a Suffolk Jew in terms of if he's Jewish, he can't be Michal Shabbos. If he's non-Jewish, he can't keep Shabbos. So Minchas Chinuch talks about this Parshas Yisro. Lama Beis Minchas Chinuch suggests that maybe the Nachri should do Malacha B'Chatzi Shir, because that's the whole discussion about Chatzi Malacha. But the Minchas Chinuch suggests that maybe you should do a Malacha B'Chatzi Shir, because even though Chatzi Shir is Aser Min HaTorah, if there's such a thing as Chatzi Shir by Malacha, but that's not a chiyuv skila. So if he's a Yisrael and he does Malacha B'Chatzi Shir, so then he's not chayiv skila. If he's a nachri, so ain't shirim lebnei noach. So there's no notion of chatzis shir by a nachri. Chatzis shir by a nachri, if even your goes to less than a shavu'ot, you do anything less than a shir, then you're still liable. So that's what the Minchas Chinuch suggests, that you could have your cake and eat it too. If you do a malacha b'chatzis shir, if you're Jewish, it's not a chiyuv gila. And if you're not Jewish, so then that's not called Shmir Shabbos, because in Hilchos B'nei Noach, you're a proper Goy Shabbos. That you're not a Goy Shabbos. That nukud about chatzis shir by B'nei Noach, relevant to yesterday's daf. Anyone here learning daf yomi? Aside from Rabbi Lubitz. So yesterday, do you talk about Gerach Katan yet?
No, this
here?
This week.
This week, ah. So I'll tell you a Gerach Katan word. How are we doing on time? It's time when it's up. I'm sorry?
Yeah.
I'm going to figure out. Okay. So apropos to Gerach Katan, so the fascinating Shuva, we mentioned Rav Natan Greenblatt passed away a couple months ago. So I had this letter of his that I had found a few years ago, unpublished, in the YU archives. The YU archives has a section of correspondence with Rav David Lifshitz of Chana Levrach, who was a Rosh Yeshiva and Yeshiva, passed away in the early 90s. So Rav Natan had written a letter to Rav David Lifshitz about the following case. Apparently, putting pieces together, speaking to the people in Memphis, the Maisa Shai was as follows. There was a family in Memphis that applied to send their kid to the local day school. And the situation was that the mother and the kid had undergone a gerus with the local conservative rabbi. So it happens to be the local conservative rabbi, not that told me this himself a couple of times over the years, the local conservative rabbi learned by Rabbi Chanan Baranovich. So, not to say, you can't really blame them. They thought that they were getting the best gerus possible. He learned by Rabbi Chanan. So they had a gerus of the local conservative rabbi. But it sounds like the family was basically observant. They're basically Shomrei Torah mitzvahs. So the correct thing would have been to do a proper gerus, lahalacha, lechumra, whatever you want to call it, under Orthodox auspices. So be megayer the mother, be megayer the kid, and then the kid can go to day school and live happily ever after. Problem was that, as you mentioned, Rav Natan was very strongly of the position that you can't be megayer anyone l'shem ishus. And he considered this to be l'shem ishus. The parents already living together. She had a conservative gayrus. They already have a kid. So Rav Natan thought that's l'shem ishus. So he wasn't prepared to be megayer the mother. So generally speaking, as you'll learn about this week, the gayrus katan is predicated on the notion of zuchus, that it's a merit for a kid to become Jewish. Most poskim assume that zachal adam shel b'fanim in the context of gerach katan means that if the kid's going to be raised in an observant household, he's going to become a shomer torah mitzvah. So then it's a zchus to be megayer. The gerach katan is al das besin. In order for besin to be able to provide their das, so that is considered to be a zchus, considered to be meritorious for the kid to be megayer, the besin has to have a comfort level that the kid's going to grow up in a shomer Torah mitzvah environment. That's why, generally speaking, when you see the sugya, you'll see minority opinions, you'll see an Efshan Ramosha, but generally speaking, the consensus about the nowadays is to be a guy or a kid. Minimally, the family has to be Orthodox affiliated, can commit to send the kid to an Orthodox day school, and be generally Shomer Kashrus, generally Shomer Shabbos, fine. And the mother has to be Jewish too. You're not going to be a guy or a kid if the mother's not Jewish. So here, the problem was, Rav Natan wasn't prepared to be the guy or the mother. The heck, he'd be the guy or the kid without the mother. So he wrote this letter to Rav David, defending himself against attack, that he thought you could be the guy or the kid here, that Lemaisa, the kid's going to be growing up in a firm environment. The only reason we're not being the guy or the mother, it's my fault, not her fault. She wants to be the guy, but I won't be the guy because I consider that the shemishas. So he thought that you could be the guy or the kid. We've had situations like that along these lines. Let's say you have a Kohen who's married to a non-halachic yoris. So, and then they become frum. So Kohen's not allowed to... Kohen definitely can't live with the nachris, and the Kohen can't live with the yoris either. So if he wasn't a Kohen, she'd be Megayer, and they live a life of Shmir Tar Misos and Shalom Yisrael. But we can't be Megayer the kid here, because... You can't be Megayer the mother, because then she's going to be yoris as the Sir LeKohen. So the best would be they should separate, but that's not always going to happen. So there have been a couple of cases over the years where chutz mi, the fact that the mother is not halachically Jewish and married to a Kohen, chutz mi da, the family is a family of Shomrei Torah Mitzvos, and Gedaliah Dor Shwartz Zichrono Levracha, our Rav Bezdin, who passed away a couple of years ago, Paskin, who was Amin Nechemia, with a Kneich Zichrono Levracha, who also passed away recently, Paskin. In a case like this, you could be Megayah their kid, Aldas Bezdin. Because basically everything's in place. The kid's going to grow up in an observant environment. You're just not being the guy or the mother for technicality. Zav and Nechemia thought maybe when the kid becomes a goy, they should do a Geirus L'Chumra. Schwartz didn't think that was necessary. So we've had a situation like this along these lines. But then, Rav Nata writes in this tshuva, another chiddush that he held the Maisa, I know, that he said the kid in this case was 5 years old. But let's say the kid was 8 or 9 years old. So the Gemara has... there on Daf Yud Aleph and Subas that you'll get to, the dinner of Yosef, Higdilu Yecholam Limchos. That there's a caveat when it comes to Ger Katan. When the Ger Katan becomes of age, he has the ability to be Mochi. He could say, I'm not interested, I'm out, and then discussion whether that's Okel or Ger Samafrei, Mikhan Laba, but then he's not Jewish anymore. So the Tosis Rid on the bottom, on the side of the Gemara there, has a line, Higdilu Yecholam Limchos sounds like when he becomes a Gadol, meaning 12 or 13, so that you can be Mochi. So the Tosafot has a line that maybe Dashir Macha isn't based on when they become a Gadol in Hilchos Yisrael 12-13, but it's a function of Das. Meaning, when it comes to Bnei Noach, as we saw the Michas Chinuch, Ras and Sofer, there's no Shi'irm LeBnei Noach. So therefore, Yisrael becomes a Gadol when you have Shanim, Simanim, when you're of age 12-13. A Nachri could become a Gadol in Hilchos Bnei Noach much younger, when they have maybe Das Putas, Das Mekach HaMemkar, when they have enough intelligence that they could engage in business, which would be a younger age. It would be subjective, but a younger age than 12 or 13. So maybe in Hilchos B'nai Noach, you can't be Megai or a Katan at the age of 9, because in Hilchos B'nai Noach, it's a Gadol. You can't be Megai them al Das Bezdin, because they're not a Gadol anymore. So they're not a Katan anymore in Hilchos B'nai Noach. So in practice, would it be Megai or kids in that window between, let's say, 7, 8, and 12, 13, because of this question, maybe ain't Shir Lebnei Noach, and there's no mechanism for Geirus Katan under those circumstances. You go on, take questions.
You guys have questions? Is how many gears is the RCA get like a year, or how many total?
So we have a network of 12 batei din around the country, and b'memutza, an average, will complete about 200 gears a year between those 12 batei din. About half of them are in the New York area, but the numbers have been pretty consistent. There was a dip during COVID, but generally about 200 a year complete. There are many more than that in process at any given time, but that's about the numbers. Yeah. So it depends what you mean by accepted, because there are complete. Yeah, okay, right. So most people are accepted, and by attrition they'll drop out because they're not ready to complete. What percentage of people that apply actually complete? I haven't crunched those numbers, but it's probably around 75%, maybe. Again, by apply, I don't mean get up one morning, make a phone call to the local Orthodox rabbi and say, I want to be Jewish. Before applying to the Bezdin means you've already taken initial steps, you've already created a relationship with the local sponsoring rabbi, he's begun teaching you, so you've already done a lot before you apply to a Bezdin. So if the question is how many people, what percentage of people that wake up one morning and say, I want to be Jewish, convert, I don't have those numbers because those people don't get to me. In terms of people that have gone far enough that they've already applied to a Bezdin, meaning they've begun a process, then the number is going to be much higher. Yeah?
How long does this process usually take when they come to you?
So we generally say that a Geirus process should take about 2 years. Every case is different. It really depends on a lot of factors. The end game is that the person needs to be properly integrated into the Orthodox community and fully observant of halacha. Different people take longer to get there. So minimally, we would expect a Geirus candidate to, let's say, be keeping Shabbos for at least a year before the Geirus. But someone coming in off the street with zero knowledge or exposure is going to take a longer time than someone raised in a conservative home with, let's say, a Jewish father, non-halachically Jewish mother, who's familiar with Jewish traditions, just hasn't been observant. And then every now and then we have people in yeshiva who wake up in the morning and realize that they're not halachically Jewish, and we have to deal with them. That's usually, if they're in yeshiva, hopefully they're already keeping Shabbos, and that'll be a quicker, more pro forma process. Yeah?
What percentage of care might down the line stay from?
That's a very good question. We try to keep data on that. We haven't been as successful as we like in keeping data, as when we started the system, we kind of had this understanding that we check in with the Batei Din, and the Batei Din would check in with sponsoring rabbis 1 year post-Geiris. We haven't been as on top of that in recent years. We probably should, but our anecdotal observations about people that have been Megayer under our system is that we're doing very well. That very, very high numbers of retention. Not to a man or to a woman, there are exceptions, but anecdotally it seems that we're doing pretty well.
Is there any lingering integration issues with a lot of Geirim or their children into the Jewish community?
So leaving aside the Syrian community, which is a parsha on its own, and the Syrian takana of not accepting Geirim at all, which is really a large step. The original Syrian takana was from the 1920s in Argentina, where it wasn't meant to exclude Geirim from the community. They just said, Geirim is a messy business. We don't want to deal with it. If you want to be Megayer, go to Eretz Yisrael. And Rav Kook wrote a letter to the chief rabbi of Argentina at the time, in the 1920s, saying, we'll be happy to take care of any serious Geirim candidate you have in Argentina. Just send them to Eretz Yisrael and we'll take care of it. So the takana then wasn't not to accept Geirim in the community. It was, we don't want to deal with it. If you want to be Megayer, go somewhere else. Somehow the 1950s that morphed into we won't accept Geirim in the community or their children or their children's children, which is highly questionable how that doesn't violate many lavin of anas hager. But leaving aside those communities, yeah, integration is a challenge. We do what we can to try to encourage rabbanim of communities, to encourage the members of the community to be welcoming and properly integrating. But yeah, there's definitely a challenge, and we all could do better in making that transition smoother. But we usually try to inform prospective Geirim of those challenges, and not, while not justifying it, but at least they should be aware of the realities, and we do what we can to do better. Yeah.
Which Jewish community do Geirim usually go to after they're going through years and all that? Do they stay there? Do they
In terms of where they live?
What Jewish community do they have?
So we, generally the communities that we work with, by and large, are within the RCA, OU, YU orbit. So for lack of a better term, we want to call it the minor Orthodox communities. We do have, there's a not insignificant number of Chabad shluchim in various places that end up with Geirim situations in their communities. Often those are smaller communities, so often people, the recommendation is that prospective Geirim is best served in a larger community that has more resources and more people that they can get to know and network with. But that being said, there are a lot of people in Megayer in smaller communities. Sometimes those people, they may be Megayer when they're single, and then when they have families, will move to larger communities because that's a much better fit. But there's definitely a large range of communities where, if you look at the list of shuls that have sponsored Geirus candidates the last number of years, it's in the hundreds. So there are many communities that maybe one every few years, or maybe some shuls that have a few a year that are bigger. There's certain demographics that attract Geirus candidates. There'll be many more Geirus candidates on the Upper West Side than in Lawrence Woodmere. So there are just certain sociological and financial demographics that they can probably figure out on your own. Yeah?
Are there any red flags that immediately exclude a candidate?
Does
RCA outline any specific red flags?
So we don't have a red flag list, but we do have guidelines as to what the expectations are. And if someone's not going to meet those expectations, then it's not going to go anywhere. It's rare to reject a candidate out of hand and to say, we absolutely won't work with you. Number one, there's a certain kind of gatekeeper first step, which is a local sponsoring rabbi. A bezin will only work with a candidate if there's a local sponsoring rabbi willing to vouch for that candidate, and has to be a sponsoring rabbi that the bezin has confidence in. So if there's a major red flag, then it's likely they're not going to get to first base and not have a sponsoring rabbi who's willing to put his reputation on the line to sponsor such a person. But there are situations where things come up that the sponsoring rabbi may not be aware of, and the bezin discovers. There have been cases where people have withheld information from the bezin, where someone is involved in, as we said, l'shem ishus isn't a non-starter, but if someone doesn't disclose a relationship, then that's a much bigger issue. So we've had cases like that where we've discovered people haven't disclosed relationships, and lying to a bezin is often a deal breaker that would end the process if you're not being upfront and honest.
I guess what group of people of the three groups of gears that we discussed, the spouses or like the Azari Yisrael type cases, mm-hmm. what about that third group of people that just fell in love with Judaism, I guess? What demographic or type of people are those people usually? Are they Ivy League educated philosophy majors, or are they random teenagers about law?
So we don't usually ask for college majors on application forms, so I haven't crunched the data to that level. It's a good question. Generally speaking, number one, there's a disproportionate number of female conversion candidates to male conversion candidates. Some are 3-1. More conversion I would say in terms of the age range, upper 20s and low 30s is probably the largest demographic. Does that fit with your experience, Robert Lewis? Yeah. So, but it's definitely a spread. We'll almost never be Megayer a teenager who's not being Megayer as part of a family, because that's just no offense to anyone here, but just a unpredictable age where people are unsettled and can't necessarily be expected to make a responsible decision about what to do with their life. I wouldn't offend anyone, but hopefully you're all Jewish anyway. If not, I'll probably hear from you outside afterwards. So we're reluctant, even college students, there's this reluctance at that transient stage of life, not that we won't do it. There are batidin that won't touch college students, but it requires a higher level of more discerning on the part of the bezdin to properly vet people who are in transient stages of life. Someone who's settled with a career, with or without a family, is more stable than someone who's just graduating college or maybe just starting graduate school or starting their professional life and aren't really rooted in any community. But every case is an individual case that's discussed on its merits. Yeah?
Did you see a spike in Gary cases after COVID?
We did it. We had a drop during COVID because we were closed, for all intents and purposes. We basically did nothing for the first few months. Then we started having meetings on Zoom. Until the mikvahs opened was a good number of months after that. In some communities, the mikvahs didn't open for over a year afterwards. We had some interesting COVID cases. There were people who were Megayer, who were ready to be Megayer at the beginning of COVID, and then everything shut down. Not that I heard of, but that's a good question. But we had we had some people where we were trying to troubleshoot and maybe find a mikvah that was open in a different part of the country for someone who couldn't access a local mikvah. There are a couple of cases like that. There's someone, we had a case of a Gioras who was Megayer in an out-of-town bezdin right before COVID. And the rabbi called me up right afterwards and said that the woman, the Gioras, called her after she went back. It was an out-of-town bezdin, and the woman had flown in from another community. So the woman only realized when she got back home that she forgot to take out her contacts, her contact lenses from her eyes before the geiris. That's a good time in halacha. So when it comes to tefilas nashim, so there's a lot to be makel about b'di'eved, definitely karlan seitz l'bayla is what to be makel about if you left your contact lenses in. But a lechachila, and the geiris is a lechachila. So you want to make sure the person is 100% halachically Jewish, so we try to cover all bases. So we felt, I discussed it with Rabbi Willig and others, that it's appropriate that the woman should do another geiris just to be sure, geiris l'chumra. But by the time we figured this out, everything shut down, and she was stuck. Nikra didn't, she was probably Jewish anyway, but we wanted to take care of the problem, just to be sure. So it took a few months till we were able to find, she ended up traveling to the other side of the country to go to a mikveh with the local bezdin there, where they already opened up the mikveh, because the mikveh in the first town still was closed. So we had some cases like that, but in terms of overall numbers, we didn't see any real discernible COVID spike. Not in Garrison, and not in Gizin.
Any interesting cases of motivation or like crazy cases of Garrison that you dealt with?
Crazy cases of Garrison. I thought I spoke about enough crazy cases already. Crazy case of motivation, meaning someone with a off the beaten track kind of motivation. Aside from good challenge. Anything come to mind?
A few. I had a dream. We were rejected, and then he said, besides, my mother was Jewish.
That's like the old Cohen joke. No, we were regarding someone also a you have these B'nai Anusim that claim lineage from 500 years ago in Spain. Usually it's hard to prove, and usually there's been so much intermarriage that you can't trace it back anyway. But there's a guy who ended up being Megayer. He had all these fascinating paraphernalia from the Dominican Republic also, I think, from the 1800s. He had a leather Megillah that was in his family. Couldn't prove that he was Jewish, but it was a fascinating artifact.
Yes, okay, Lemaisa, if a Ger's mother or father dies, so what is the Hadrach of the Beis Din gives in terms of if they want to observe some form of that
Halo? You must be reading Rabbi Yair Hoffman's columns. So Rabbi Shechter always says that you can volunteer a Velus. So, strictly speaking, if a person's parents aren't Jewish, there's no halakha requirement for a velus. There may be some level of kibud avim even for a parent that's not Jewish. So, if the person wants to observe geiris l'chumra, that's not to be discouraged. So they can observe a velus l'chumra, that's not to be discouraged. L'chumra means that you can't wear geiris has certain kula, so to speak, meaning you wouldn't be noeg aninus and atzei brachos, or you wouldn't, if there's a chiv talmud Torah, you wouldn't not engage in talmud Torah because lemaisa you're not an avil, so there's no tour of or hafka of talmud Torah. But to the extent that you want to, you can volunteer avilus for any situation. It's even if you have a non-religious karov. If it's not a tinoch shenishba, maybe even if it is mikra, then there's no avelus also. But most people are knowing avelus for their irreligious relatives. If it's not mikra, then it's at least on a voluntary basis. So that's what we recommend. People should find what they're comfortable with, and if they feel comfortable practicing some sort of avelus, then that's not to be discouraged.
Mm-hmm.
That's an excellent question. So along the lines of what we discussed, I think there is a kiruv imperative for such people, meaning if you have someone that is Suffolk Jewish, you should try to be mekarvim. It doesn't mean that you could do a halacha geirus if there's not going to be a proper kabbalas hamitzvahs, but you shouldn't push those people away also. This happens all the time, especially, you get this question every couple of weeks with some chabad shliya somewhere, where they're asked to do bar mitzvah for someone whose mother had a non-halachic conversion. Somewhere outside of, you know, in the hick towns, if you will, or the one-horse towns, where, you know, one-horse towns with one chabad, they get a lot more questions about bar mitzvahs than about anything else. So somehow that's, they're not calling about chassan, they're calling about bar mitzvahs. So this happens all the time. You have someone whose mother, let's say, had a non-halachic conversion. They're connected on some level to the local chabad. So on the one hand, you can't have a bar mitzvah ceremony in a way that's going to give the impression the person's halachically Jewish. But on the other hand, there's a suffix enough that you don't want to push them away. You want to be mekarev them to the point that maybe not now, but maybe in 5 years, maybe in 10 years, they'll be able to do a proper halachic geirus l'chum. So that's avodah kasha shebimikdash. That's a really hard balance to find, that there's no one-size-fits-all answer, and it's, that's one of the big challenges in the rabbinate at large, particularly in these small towns, how to navigate those situations.
Maybe just one more question that guys can ask privately afterwards.
We discussed briefly this year a family coming to the guy here, and one of the kids, like a chirish or a shoda. How does the RC
Wow, that's a doozy of a last question. So that's another shiur. You have to invite me back another time. So Cheresh breaks down. Cheresh breaks down as follows: what is halacha Cheresh? So Cheresh usually translates as a deaf mute. So that's a major discussion in the literature. 100 years ago, 150 years ago, if you have an intelligent deaf mute, is he halacha Cheresh? I actually have a piece about that in my sefer. It was a correspondence I had with the Rosh Weiss, who has a tshuva to me in Chayil Beizim in Chas Asher, which I only... he forgot to send it to me, so I only found the tshuva once the sefer was published. So I was surprised when he opened it up, and there it was, because I had corresponded a couple years ago. It ended up not being Nogeya. That was in the context of can a cheresh, the whole seder get cheresh for a cheresh. Can an intelligent cheresh be m'man a shliach, because a get cheresh can be done al yidei shliach. That was a... Maisa Shaiu out of the bed and ended up not being Nogeya. So threshold question number one is what's the halachic status of an intelligent deaf mute? So L'chumra, when it comes to a matter of Gittin, so we're Machmir because there's nothing to lose to do a Ger Cheresh even if it's not absolutely necessary. Can you be Megayer a Megayer Cheresh? So then that becomes a lot more complicated. Is he halachic Bardas? Because when it comes to Geirus, you're not going... There, the chumra is a kula, meaning you have to be fully comfortable. The person could be halachically Jewish. There's a little bit of literature about that in the Rabbanut. Baruch Hashem, bli ayin hara, I guess we haven't had to deal with it in the Bezdin. I don't think we've had such a case, and we'd have to think long and hard if we did how to navigate it. Okay, thank you so much.